This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Some songs are sung time and again, recorded time and again. When we hear them, we might be swept back in time or into a mood. These songs also have something to tell us about where we've been and where we are today. Let's listen to a tune from a 1928 musical that's still with us. Here it's performed by Cyndi Lauper and Tony Bennett.
Another bride, another June, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee.
A lot of shoes, a lot of rice. The groom is nervous. Who can blame him? He answers twice. It's really killing, but he's so willing to make whoopee. Picture a little love nest.
I got you.
Down where the roses cling.
It's very romantic.
Picture that same sweet love nest. Think what a year can bring.
I'm with you.
He's washing dishes, oh, and baby clothes.
He should.
He's so ambitious, not really. He even sews.
2003, babe.
But don't forget, folks, that's what you get, folks,
for making whoopee.
On the program today, we're going to talk about the American popular songs of the 20th century. Our guests this afternoon are Philip Furia and Michael Lasser, authors of America's Songs, the stories behind the songs of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley. Listeners, I invite your phone calls. You can join us with your questions and comments about American popular music. Call us and tell us one of your favorite standards, and our guests will no doubt be able to tell you its story. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guests. Philip Furia chairs the Department of Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. He's the author of several books about music, including The Poets of Tin Pan Alley. He's also written biographies of Irving Berlin, Ira Gershwin, and Johnny Mercer. Michael Lasser, you may recognize his name thanks to his Peabody Award-winning radio program, Fascinating Rhythm, which has been on the air since 1980, and you can hear it on our companion station, WILL-FM, on Friday afternoons at 4:06 p.m. Philip's and Michael's book, America's Songs, the stories behind the songs of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley, is published by Routledge Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Philip, Michael, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Pleasure. Good to be here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we started out with As Time Goes By and Whoopee. Tell us about these songs.
Well, as time goes by, it's you really did a nice job with picking the songs, because Phil knows about some and I know about some because we wrote different parts of the book. So Whoopi's mine, and so's As Time Goes By. As Time Goes By was written actually in the early 30s and was a flop, basically. Rudy Valley had a recording, but it was no great shakes. And there was a young man who had gone to Cornell in the 30s, and he loved the song. He became a playwright, and he wrote a play called Everybody Meets at Rick's. And he needed a song for the two lovers, and he remembered that song, and he stuck it in there. And then eventually the play opened and closed. It was a flop, too. But Hollywood used to devour material for movies. It didn't need to be a hit. It just needed to be adaptable. And they bought this thing, and they made it into a movie. And they need to have a song. And the man who did the music for the movie didn't like it very much, but the producer, Hal Wallace, found out that Warner Brothers, which was making the movie, had the rights to the song. They owned the music publishing house that had published the song in the first place, so they were able to get the song for almost free, so they kept it. But the composer, Max Steiner, kept pressing. He wanted to get rid of that song. And so Hal Wallace finally agreed, except Mike Curtiz, the director, had finished shooting and the cast had been released. Ingrid Bergman had gone on to the cast of Casablanca. Ingrid Bergman had gone on to make For Whom the Bell Tolls, and she had to cut her hair very short for the part. When Wallace saw that, he realized he'd have to get her a wig, and he said, the heck with it, it's not worth it. If Ingrid Bergman had not had a haircut, As Time Goes By would have been dropped from Casablanca and would never have become the classic American song that it is.
Mm, what a great story.
So, be lucky.
Yeah.
That was also the song that brought Michael and me together. We didn't know each other, and actually we struck up a friendship over the radio. I had written another book about 12 years ago about American popular song, and Larry King had me on Larry King Live, his old radio show, for 2 hours. And I told some stories about some of the songs we played, and the next day I got an email from Michael Lasser, whom I'd never heard of, and he said, I heard you on Larry King last night, you told some great stories, but have you ever heard the story about As Time Goes By? I said, no. So he sent the story he just told you, that wonderful story, to me by email, and of course I didn't want to be top, so I said, have you ever heard the great story about Easter Parade, how that was originally a song called Smile and Show Your Dimple that was a flop for Berlin, and he put it away in his trunk and about 20 years later brought it out and it became, rewrote it as Easter Parade, In Your Easter Bonnet with All the Frills Upon It. And we started swapping email stories, and I began looking at these over the years, and I thought, my goodness, this would make a great book of the great stories behind the song. So starting with As Time Goes By is very apt, because that's the thing that got us started.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, it goes back so far, there was no email. We started with actually typing letters to one another.
Well, let's not date ourselves.
Well, I don't know about you, but I remember most of these songs.
And now we have American popular song Whoopee. We have to tell that story.
Okay, it's not as much of a Paul Harvey kind of thing, and that's the rest of the story. But it's from a show called Whoopee. And what's interesting about the song, I think, is it's one of the few songs about divorce. Vintage 1928. The only other really good song, well, there's Tammy Wynette's D-I-V-O-R-C-E, but there's another wonderful song about divorce from 1938 called Thanks for the Memory that became Bob Hope's theme song. You know, it's one of those songs we know so well, nobody ever listens to it.
Yeah.
But if you do, it's a song about divorce. And making whoopee, of course, is the slang expression for sex. But and even though the song is ironic, And very playful about the idea of divorce, Eddie Cantor, who introduced it and who was known for a very active style of performance, he would cavort all over the stage. But when he sang this song, it was very restrained and very quiet. He let the song do it. He let the song present its own cynical view of marriage and a divorce court who dumps on the husband, and as all a result of the extramarital whoopee. And the song was an enormous hit then and has lasted down the 70 years, 80 years to now.
Yeah, and I love the Cyndi Lauper, Tony Bennett version of it. It's so much, if you can have a song about divorce, that's fun.
Right, and it's so great to see singers from two generations. You know, still singing those same great songs.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting on line one in Urbana to talk with us. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about one of my favorite songs. It's an old Bobby Darin song, Mack the Knife. And I understand it's a much older song that he, like, redid it or something. Is that true?
Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, it's actually the song comes from a 1927 German operetta by Kurt Weill, the composer, and Bertolt Brecht, the playwright. And Its German name was Moritat, a death song. It was recorded by Bobby Darin, by Louis Armstrong, by Frank Sinatra, a whole lot. Ella Fitzgerald did a recording. It became enormously popular in the 1950s, but it's, again, a song that has its roots back in the 1920s.
And it became popular in the 50s because it was revived off-Broadway in New York and given a musical score and became an enormous hit in New York in the 1950s. And so that's when people like Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra picked it up and recorded it.
Oh, I see. Well, when did Lottie Lenya sing it? Because that's one of the old recordings that I'd heard.
Yeah, she was married to Kurt Weill, the composer.
Oh, I see.
And she sang it. Well, she probably would have sung it in the 1940s.
So were there a lot of, like, political undertones to this song? Or?
Well, it's a very cynical song. It's about a murderer, Mack the Knife. It celebrates the culture of thieves and crime. It's Brecht was a very left-wing socialist communist writer, and it's a very anti-capitalistic play, and it celebrates the criminal as the opponent of the capitalists who run the civilized world. So, yeah, it's a very sophisticated lyric.
Huh. Oh, well, thank you very much.
Sure.
You're very welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Our topic this afternoon, America's popular songs. Our guests are Philip Furia and Michael Lasser. You know, that call and that song, Mack the Knife, brings me to think of a couple of other sophisticated musicals where we have popular tunes come from. Cabaret in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Michael, those are yours.
Cabaret and Chicago, both by Fred Ebb and John Kander,
mm-hmm.
And both very dark musicals. In fact, Chicago opened in the 70s on Broadway. My wife and I went to see it, and we were standing in the lobby at intermission, and my wife said to me, "I hate everybody in the show, meaning the characters, and I'm loving it. I don't get it." And I said, "You may hate Velma, but you love Cheetah Rivera and Gwen Verdon. You may hate Billy Flynn, but you love Jerry Orbach." I don't know if people know this, but Jerry Orbach, before he was on Law and Order,
mm-hmm.
was an important leading man in Broadway musicals.
And he has a marvelous voice.
Yes, he did. He was the original El Gallo in The Fantastics back in 1960. Mm-hmm. He was Billy Flynn, the cynical lawyer. And in Chicago, what Bob Fosse and Fred Ebb, who wrote the book, came up with was making it what they subtitled a musical vaudeville. And every character and every song was modeled loosely on either a style of song or a star from vaudeville, so that Billy Flynn was modeled on Ted Lewis, and Mama Morton was modeled on Sophie Tucker, and so on. You didn't need to know that. In fact, in the revival, that's I guess still running. It's been running for a long, long time. That idea was pretty much dropped. But in the original, that was very much part of the way in which the show was presented. And it was not as successful then as it is now. I guess the world was not as receptive to dark musicals as it is now. But it was a ferociously dark musical with a ferociously dark backstage story, because Fosse had a heart attack, and when he came back, he was absolutely miserable to everybody. In fact, Gwen Verdon, who was married to him, one snap during one of his tirades, "They can pack his heart in sawdust as far as I'm concerned." It was a rough play on stage, and it was rough getting it on stage.
Yeah, and that period of his life wasn't that material for the film about Fosse?
All that jazz. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Spring Bay, line 4. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Well, Jerry Orbach was a graduate of the University of Illinois.
Oh, great.
Very, what do you know?
Very talented. Also, I've heard that the Mac the Knife song was used by the French Underground. And the reference was the shark has pearly teeth and he shows them pearly white is the Nazis. And just a jackknife has McKeith and he keeps it out of sight mm-hmm. is the French Underground.
Oh, very interesting.
That was always
I did not know that. I'll tell you another story about another song that's maybe related to that. When the Nazis occupied Denmark, they controlled the radio stations, and they got their propaganda out. But every night before the station signed off in Copenhagen, the Danish radio would undo all of the Nazi propaganda by simply playing the Gershwin song, It Ain't Necessarily So.
I've got a Jerry Orbach story for you that really is a cautionary tale about show business. After he was in the Fantastics and really established himself very effectively, he went on to co-star in a musical called Carnival. It was a lovely show based on the movie Lily with Leslie Caron. And Anna Maria Alberghetti played Lily, and Jerry Orbach played Paul, the puppeteer, the crippled puppeteer. And so he had to learn to use puppets. And he did, of course, and they were used in the show. And when the show closed after a very good run, he had so much trouble getting work that he supported himself for something like 5 years appearing with those puppets on Saturday morning children's television, the Shari Lewis show.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. Yep, his puppets would come out and talk with Lamb Chop.
Yeah.
And that's how, think about that one. And that's how he survived until he was able to pick up another show. And then later in his career, when he finally got a movie, the Woody Allen movie, and then went on from that to television and made the big money in the last years of his life, somebody asked him why he'd never done movies or television before. And this is a guy who, at that point, had a 25-year career. And he said, nobody ever asked me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw Lotta Lenya in Cabaret on Broadway.
Oh, my.
And she was playing, Pineapple for You, mm-hmm. Frau, what's her name? And when she made her entrance, the entire theater stopped the show with applause just on her entrance.
Those kind of entrances, when a star you've never had a chance to either see in person, when you've never had a chance to respond to that star, it often happens with people who are in the movies because they're not there. Mm-hmm. I saw it happen when I saw Sugar Babies, when the spotlight picked out Mickey Rooney, for whom people had great residual affection. And he was facing away from us, his back was to us, and a pin spot picked him out. And he turned around, and there was an ovation, because all of those memories that people had simply rose up. It was an enormously emotional moment, because people had that great residual affection. Yeah. It wasn't a matter of the fact that Lotta Lenya hit a lovely note on Tuesday, October 9th. It was what she had been for those people so long.
Exactly. It was her career that they were standing for. Yeah. They didn't stand, but they stopped the show. Finally, and I'll just get off then, Lotta Lenya plays the sadistic East German KGB agent who kills people by stabbing them with a poison knife that comes out of her boot in From Russia with Love.
Right.
Yep, yep.
Well, good conversation. I'll get off and listen. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Thank you very much for your stories. Let's talk with a listener now in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hi. I just had a real quick question. I'll take my answer off the air. I wanted to know the story behind Fly Me to the Moon. I heard it recently in a movie. I'm only 22 years old. I'm not very old. I don't know these things, but I love that song.
the Bart Howard song, Flying.
Right. That was originally called In Other Words,
In Other Words, yeah. Mm-hmm. And was it Peggy Lee, Phil? I think it was Peggy Lee who said, you've got to call this song Fly Me to the Moon.
Right.
And, of course, he resisted, as songwriters do for those kinds of things. When UB Blake wrote I'm Just Wild About Harry, he wrote it as a slow waltz. And the singer and his lyricist, Noble Sissel, ganged up on him and said, you've got to speed that thing up if you want us to do it right. And 40 years later, he was still complaining about what they did to his pretty waltz. Same thing here. Howard loved the song, and he had given it that title. But once he changed it, it did, in fact, take off. And he once said that he what he mainly wanted to do was be so successful he could stop working. He said it took him 20 or 25 years to learn to write well enough so he didn't have to write anymore. And this song became virtually his annuity.
Right. It was the only big hit he ever had. And, I mean, this is a guy who came from Iowa, Burlington, Iowa, and he did everything. He worked in carnivals with Siamese twins, played piano for a female impersonator. I mean, you talk about coming
but
up in
show business.
But he also
played piano for Mabel Mercer.
That's right, the great Mabel Mercer.
I don't know. People don't know Mabel Mercer. And unfortunately, most of the recordings available are from late in her life, and her voice really degenerated. But for style, for a lyric, for a singer who has a grasp of the emotional content of a lyric, there is no greater singer than Mabel Mercer, who was a great stylist without ever changing a single note.
Another great reader of lyrics, of course, is the man who made that song so popular, Fly Me to the Moon, Frank Sinatra.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Howard had written it as a very slow, sad, romantic ballad. And Sinatra just recorded it as a real up-tempo,
well, it was
upbeat song. And, yeah, it changed the character.
Songs for lovers, yeah.
Yeah. And it turned up in the movie. I don't know which movie this young woman saw it in, but it turned up in the movie about the great con artist.
Right, and also Space Cowboys.
Space Cowboys.
Yes, I think.
Do you get to see movies I don't get to?
It's the end of Space Cowboys when the astronaut who's stranded on the moon is lying there, and the Sinatra song comes over the soundtrack. It's a wild moment.
Is that the one with Clint Eastwood and the old guys?
Yeah, the old guys.
Okay, I know the one you mean.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk about Fly Me to the Moon as Sinatra did it and as the man who wrote it intended it. You know, I think of a tune like Happy Days, you know, that up-tempo that the Democrats used it forever.
Happy Days are here again.
Yes. Are here again. And then Barbara Streisand took it.
Took it very slow.
Very slow.
And turned it down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a Depression anthem.
Mm-hmm.
But it really was written before the Depression. It was a 20s song, and it's got that kind of perky bounciness we associate with a lot of 20s songs. And you get a sense from listening to it, if you separate it from When, that any problems it refers to aren't very serious anyway. Just everything's going to be fine. And the songwriters, Milt Ager and Jack Yellen, who wrote it, even though they were quarreling terribly and were about to separate, wrote it for a movie. And the movie was so bad that MGM decided not to release it. And they had this song on their hands, so they took it over to a band leader named George Olson, who was very popular at the time. And he played it. He introduced it. And it so happened that he introduced it on Black Thursday. And he started to play Happy Days Are Here Again. And the few people in the nightclub started to laugh uproariously. And they handed out the words. And one by one, people would go up to the microphone from the audience, from the club, and roar out the words, these now absurd words, given what had just happened that day. And the song's reputation spread. People picked it up. It got on the radio. And it was the Democratic Party's theme song,
mm-hmm,
from Franklin Roosevelt in 1932 through John Kennedy in 1960.
Hmm. You know, these songs, one of the things that you say at the outset of the book is that they're extravagant in sentiment and expansive in emotion. Why are we so drawn to that? Why do we, most of us, enjoy the sentiment, the emotion? And there's also cleverness involved as well, too.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the great songwriters, Yip Harburg, who wrote Over the Rainbow and It's Only a Paper Moon and wrote the lyrics for Finian's Rainbow, he said the trick for them all, and he was friends, he went to school with Ira Gershwin, and all these people knew each other and would hang out together. And in some ways, you know, they wrote for each other. You know, be sitting around and playing poker or shooting pool, and someone would sit at the piano and say, here's my latest song. You can imagine with people like George and Ira Gershwin, Cole Porter, Jerome Kern in the room, you're not going to do anything bad as a composer or lyricist. But Harburg once said that the trick in all of these songs for them was to say the same old thing, I love you, but to always say it with a twist, always turn the emotion so that it's a little more complicated than some of the songs we don't remember from that era who didn't endure. It's, you know, the cleverness of one of my favorite lyricists is Lorenz Hart, you know, who can say in a love song, words I love you till the day I die, the self-deception that believes the lie. Mm-hmm. I wish I were. I mean, you know, just think about that. You know, you're so in love that you know your lover's lying, but you enjoy being self-deceived enough to believe her.
And Cole Porter even has a song called I Hate You, Darling.
Yes.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guests this afternoon are Michael Lasser and Philip Furia. They are the authors of America's Songs, the stories behind the songs of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley.
May I add a word to
sure.
You had said separate from the wit. I don't think you can separate it from the wit, because one of the things that's amazing about these men, and a few women as well, is their ability to express great emotion, intense emotion, deeply felt emotion, with wit. You know, common wisdom says that emotion and humor don't go together. The more intensely you feel, the harder it is to crack a joke. But these people knew how to do it. They knew how to keep their sense of language about them when they were writing about intense emotion, because they weren't writing about their own emotion. They were conveying emotion. And I think to take the wit out of it, to take the wordplay out of it, is to lose part of what makes the songs distinctive and part of what gives them their enormous appeal.
Yeah. Well, in a moment, we're going to play a Cole Porter tune, You're the Top. And we can hear the playfulness, which I love. That's just the song. You know, who hasn't had that feeling of infatuation?
Except, you know, it was originally a friendship song.
Oh, really?
Yeah, originally sung between two friends in Anything Goes. And then through when it became a pop song on the radio, it got turned over into a...
Oh.
We made the assumption that it was about love.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're going to play that tune in just a moment, but first we're going to talk with someone who's waiting to talk with us on a cell phone in Effingham on line 4. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. I had just a quick question and a brief story, and I'll hang up. Was wondering about the song Moon River. I find it one of the most maudlin songs, but I was wondering about the term Huckleberry Friend, and always was curious about that, if there was, what the background was, if there was one. And then you were talking about Mickey Rooney, and this is just a quick story. There used to be a radio announcer in Chicago who would interview all the stars and whatnot, and he said his most difficult interview that he ever had was with Mickey Rooney. And I love Mickey Rooney. I don't have anything against the guy, but he said he was just a very difficult person to work with, and I didn't know perhaps if your guests had any insight on either one of those two things. I'll go ahead and hang up and listen.
Phil, tell him about Moon River, and I'll tell him a Mickey Rooney story.
Okay. Moon River was written by Johnny Mercer, the lyricist, who grew up in Savannah, Georgia. He was one of the few songwriters of that era not to come from New York. And when he was a kid, they'd play on the marshes in Savannah, and he and his friends would go huckleberrying, that is, picking huckleberries. and then they'd go and, you know, their parents would make some ice cream for them. So it was a kind of a tender boyhood memory for him. Mercer had been an enormously successful songwriter in the 40s. At one point, half of the songs on the hit parade had a lyric by Johnny Mercer. I mean, this guy, it was like the Joe DiMaggio of songwriting. I mean, mm-hmm. He just had hit after hit. But by the 1960s, he was considered washed up. He hadn't had a hit in years. No one would hire him to write a song. So he went to a young composer, Henry Mancini, and said, I would like to work with you. And Mancini, of course, was moved. I mean, he knew how great Mercer was. And he played Johnny Mercer this melody. And Mercer went home to work on it. And he came back with a lyric called Blue River. Blue River. And Mancini liked it, but then they found out there was another song called Blue River. So Mercer said, well, I'm going to change the title. How about to keep that nice long ooh sound? Instead of blue, we'll call it Moon River.
Mm.
And he wrote up the lyric, and everyone hated the line about my Huckleberry friend. Nobody knew what it meant. Is he talking about Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn? And Mercer just put his foot down and said, no, that line is going to stay. And it's, of course, the line that everybody remembers from the song. And the song became a hit. It won the Academy Award. The following year, Mercer and Mancini did it again with one of his greatest songs, Days of Wine and Roses, and his career was back.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mickey Rooney. In a former life, I was a theater critic. And one of the things I used to do, in addition to reviewing the plays, I would sometimes interview someone and do a preview of the opening, interview the playwright or one of the performers. And Sugar Babies was going to open for a run in town, and so I arranged through whoever, the publicist, to interview Mickey Rooney. And I called him up at a time that he had insisted I call him, an inconvenient time for me. He wasn't there. I called again. He wasn't there. It took me over an hour to reach him, and I've got a deadline pressing on the back of my neck. And I get him on the phone, and I swallow everything because I've got to get the interview. And good evening, Mr. Rooney. And I ask him a question, and he talks for 15 minutes, never answers the question, tells me what his investments are for the future. He's going to open up an amusement park, and it's all hot air. It's all Mickey Rooney being Mickey Rooney. And he finally winds down, and I ask him another question, thinking, well, all right, that didn't work. Let me try this. And you come at it from a different angle, and he does the same thing. He was arguably the worst interview I ever had, and I virtually made up the interview because he never said one thing in 45 minutes. It's supposed to be a 15-minute interview. My part of it went on for about 2 minutes. He talked and talked and talked, and it was all gas. It was one of the worst. It was arguably the worst one in how long did I do these things? In 15 years that I ever had.
Isn't that terrible when you're so looking forward to talking with somebody and getting the story and then, ugh.
So
falls
flat. You know, Mickey Rooney is like Niagara Falls. Slowly I turned. It's one of those names that makes the smoke come out of my ears.
Well, what do you say we go back to Cole Porter? And,
great.
And you're
good
the top.
Good place to go.
Okay. Because you two are tops as far as an interview goes. This is great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're the
shucks.
Top. Oh, shucks. Here's Bobby Short, Danville, Illinois native who made his career in New York City. Bobby Short, you're the top.
At words poetic, I'm so pathetic, but I always have found it best, instead of getting them off my chest, to let them rest unexpressed. I hate parading my serenading, as I'll probably miss a bar. But if this ditty is not so pretty, at least it'll tell you how great you are. You're the top. You're the Colosseum. You're the top. You're the Louvre Museum. You're a melody from a symphony by Strauss. You're a Bendel bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet. You're Mickey Mouse. You're the Nile. You're the Tower of Pisa. You're the smile on the Mona Lisa. I'm a worthless check, a total wreck, a flop. But if baby I'm the bottom, you're the top. You're the top. You're my Mahatma Gandhi. You're the top. You're Napoleon Brandy. You're the purple light of a summer night in Spain. You're the National Gallery. You're Garbo's salary. You're cellophane. You're sublime. You're a turkey dinner. You're the time of the Derby winner. I'm a toy balloon that's faded soon to pop. But if baby I'm the bottom, you're the top.
Bobby Short, You're the Top. What a great tune.
Great.
Yeah,
what
that's
a great performer.
What's called a very popular kind of song in the 1930s, a catalog song or a list song. Mm. And Cole Porter was the master of this kind of song that just goes on and on, image after image, allusion after allusion, each one topping the other one. And one of the things he does in this one that I love is he takes all these images of from European high culture, you know, the Louvre Museum, the Mona Lisa, and then he wraps off each one with something from American pop culture. You know, your Mickey Mouse, your Ovaltine, your cellophane, you're the pants on a Roxy Usher. And the song stopped the show every time Ethel Merman did it in Anything Goes. And audiences kept demanding encores, and so Porter kept having to add more choruses. I mean, there must be about eight of them. Bobby Short just sang three there. But it could go on, and finally Porter just said, I can't write any more lyrics. And so the audience kept clapping for one performance, and Merman just waved them quiet and said, we can't sing any more encores. There are no more lyrics. But Cole Porter was the master of that kind of catalog list song.
Yeah. Well, now let's go back and talk some more about Johnny Mercer. At the outset of the book, you quote Sinatra on Mercer. Do you have it at hand, what Sinatra said about a Johnny Mercer lyric?
Oh, Michael gave me this one.
I don't have it in front of me.
I remember when he told it to me, I just flipped. A Johnny Mercer lyric is all the wit you wish you had and all the love you've ever lost.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And when I did my biography of Mercer, I found one of the sources of that, all the love you've ever lost. I mean, the wit was always there. But Mercer, he was a married man, had just adopted a little girl. He fell madly in love with Judy Garland in the early 1940s. And she was engaged to marry her first husband, David Rose, and they had a passionate affair for about a year. And then people at the studio just came to Garland and said, you know, you finally had some success with The Wizard of Oz. You better break off this affair with this married guy and marry the guy you're engaged to. And so she broke it off with Mercer, and he never got over it. It flared up a few times over, you know, the course of their careers. But if you look at the songs he wrote before the Garland affair, there are clever songs like Jeepers Creepers and You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby and I'm an Old Cowhand. After Garland, in the early 1940s, you start getting songs like One for My Baby, you know, that Sinatra one, It's Quarter to Three, There's No One in the Place Except You and Me, that old Black Magic, very sensuous song, Blues in the Night. There's a whole new depth of emotional loss and sadness that I think really makes Mercer one of the greatest of lyricists. And that love you ever lost, for him, his muse was Judy Garland.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to be really careful. And I think Phil has just done it in a masterful way. You've got to be very careful not to assume that because somebody had oatmeal for breakfast when he really wanted scrambled eggs, he's going to go upstairs and write a sad song. It's not about what happened to you today. In that sense, the songs are not personal. Somebody once asked Sammy Kahn, the lyricist, which came first, the music or the words, and he said the phone call. That is, it was work. They weren't writing about themselves. I once asked Kahn, because I had a chance to interview him, if his songs were in any way personal. He wouldn't even answer the question. It was so stupid. He was doing his work. He understood the difference between sincerity and integrity. The song had its own integrity. But that doesn't mean that what happens to you in your life doesn't come through in the song, even though you're not writing about yourself. And I think that's I think you find that more in Mercer and Lorenz Hart's lyrics than in any of the others.
Yeah. Well, one of the stories in the book that you tell about All That Jazz from Chicago is that Ebb and Kander came up with that really quickly, and then they stayed out of touch.
Yes, they stayed out of touch, so Bob Fosse would think it was hard work.
Hard work, yeah. That's a great story.
And, of course, you never know. Sometimes they would sit down and knock a song off in an hour. I mean, they're 32 bars long, most of them. They're not operas that they're writing.
Yeah.
This is not nuclear physics. This is popular music.
Yeah.
And there are patterns and formulas that a lot of them broke a lot of the time, but they also used them. And they got to be very adept at what they were doing, and they would sometimes knock off a melody or a lyric in no time. And what Kander and Ed did was hide it so that Bob Fosse would treat it with more respect. Little self-serving, harmless self-serving,
yeah,
deception.
That's a great story.
Especially since Fosse was such a son of a gun.
Yeah, yeah. We have to wrap up. I want to wrap up with Over the Rainbow. We began with As Time Goes By, which almost wasn't in the movie Casablanca. This song was almost not in the movie The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, right from the very beginning. The composer, Harold Arlen, played the melody for his lyricist, Yip Harburg. And Harburg said, oh, not that. That's too big a song for little Dorothy to sing. He said, that's for Nelson Eddy. And they argued and argued. They finally went over to their friend Ira Gershwin's house. And Arlen started to play the melody for Gershwin with all the big flourishes. And Ira said, no, stop, Harold. Just take one finger and plink the melody out. And Harburg said, whoa, when I heard it that way, I realized it was a great song and it would work for Judy Garland.
It's one of the universal American, it's one of the universal songs. Ernie Harburg and his wife, Ernie is Yip's son, liked to go to see ruins in South America, and they were on this Toonerville trolley in the mountains of God knows where. Everybody on the bus was either probably Indian background. Their inheritance was Aztec or Incan or whatever, and they're all speaking either Quechua, which is the Incan language, apparently is still used, or Spanish. And Ernie's wife speaks Spanish. And so they got along fine, and Ernie and the people on the bus adopt them, make them their new friends, and are singing their songs for them. And Ernie and Dina decide they need to sing a song for their new friends. And so they pick one of Yip's, they pick Over the Rainbow. And Ernie says that within four bars, everybody on the bus was singing Over the Rainbow. It wasn't in English, but they all knew it.
Yeah.
It's the universal American song.
Well, let's wrap up here with Yip Harburg singing it, Over the Rainbow. And Philip and Michael, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it has been delightful. Thank you.
Let's do it again some point down the line.
Great.
Okay.
Let's do it.
All right. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Yeah.